Mr. Tiffin, Real 2. We were talking about after you'd been called up in September 1939, and you were actually based in Seaburn Hall. What were the living conditions like in Seaburn Hall?
Well, compared with some conditions which we had later, I mean, I suppose it would be considered good. We were in this hall, we slept on the floor.
Did you have any bedding proper? Or mattresses, straw?
Mattresses, I think. Stuffed with straw. But we were in a proper building. So, temporary, anyhow. So, yes, it was rather, I suppose, it might have been considered cushy, but we were lucky we were in territory of Italy. We'd come back to our own town.
And what about food, things like that? Did the army supplier get itself sorted out early?
I seem to remember that it was all right. That's a matter of opinion. As I say, having been away at school, I was used to communal food, if you like to put it that way. I was more tolerant of the stuff.
Now, what about your fellow other ranks? Were they from similar backgrounds to yourself, or mixed, or what?
Very mixed. There was one or two people that I knew, my particular friend.
What was his name?
Spicker. He's now dead.
So, you were from the commercial, well, office boys, basically, of Clark's.
He was, actually, I think, in the electrical trade. His family had been in the electrical trade, so he was doing that. He'd been to Bean School, the local grammar school. So there was himself and one or two others, I suppose, of similar background. A lot of them were what you call roughs from the East End of Sunderland at that time. Jolly good chaps.
Did you get on with them straight away?
No, not straight away, because they thought you were soft if you didn't speak like them. So I had one or two.
There was a noticeable difference in accent. I mean, you're all from Sunderland, but...
Yeah.
You could tell, could you? Think,
sure, I mean, they were talking like this, you know, like with a broad accent, you know. Whereas I was, I suppose, slightly more refined. This was a meeting bone of contention. If you didn't speak exactly the same, you were, you know, something different.
Was there any trouble between the groups?
Oh, yes, only initially. I had trouble because I suppose I was even. More difficult, having been away to school in the south of England, my accent was less. But that was sorted out by...
What form did the trouble take in those early days?
I wouldn't like to say it was trouble, but I must emphasise that one or two of the people I since became firm friends with, it was just a difference of background. What form of trouble? Oh, I mean, they'd come up and say, pick a fight with you. As I said, having been to away at school, I was used to a hard life. And most of these fellows I was more than a match for, so they left you alone.
So there was the odd fight?
Oh, yes. Old people fighting on the side. Not necessarily only that, but I mean young men.
Did it trouble you then?
Oh, no.
How long was it before this settled down? I mean.
Oh, very quickly. Very quickly. Because.
Oh, well, we'll come to that. So, but during this period at Seaburn Hall, there was still a bit of trouble.
Oh, yes, but I wouldn't like to overemphasize because I made some very good friends there.
So you started to make friends there?
Oh, yes.
Did you look down yourself then, before you made friends, did you look down at perhaps the rougher East End lads?
Oh, no.
You never had that attitude?
No.
So you feel it was them more resenting you?
Oh, yes.
What about your NCOs? Do you remember any in particular? I know you don't remember names particularly, but...
this regiment at the time, a lot of them were local people, some of whom you knew, people older than yourself. For example, I had a cousin who was 8 years older than me. He was an NCO, and he just remained an NCO because he was older and reasonably educated. I mean, he had no army experience. After we were mobilised, we got in one or two reservists and people, I suppose.
did most of the, so you were a new regiment, were most of the people learning together, NCOs included?
Yes, very much so.
But they brought in a few regulars, or were they, well, reservists, regulars, to sort of leaven it?
Yeah, well, I think some of them, when I say reservists, I think some of them were perhaps from other territorial regiments, from Shields, I think, one or two of them came, who'd been in the First World War, but were territorial soldiers.
So that's it. What about you? Were there a mixture of classes amongst the NCOs, or would they normally be from the better educated men?
No, there was a mixture, because there was some of them who'd been in other territorial units.
But the men who were just picked out to be NCOs without any experience, would they normally be from the slightly commercial classes?
Yes.
What about your officers? Did you have much to do with them in them very early days?
Not really, no.
Did you respect them and know who they were? And that, I mean,
some of them knew who they were from civilian life. As we were very young, they tended to be older than us. And as I said at that time, neither myself nor my friend's family were very well off. I mean, we were poor, really, after our father died. So we didn't mix in their circle. We couldn't afford it. Although, as I said, one of them was my own cousin.
Did you have any impressions as to the officer's competence at the time? You wouldn't have much to base it on, I think, bro.
Not really. I mean, you knew them. People knew them from, there might have been perhaps a local solicitor or even a senior clerk or bank clerk.
So at that stage, you more knew them by their civilian connections than by anything you knew about them. So what were you doing while you were at Seaburn Hall? I mean, your routine training or activities?
Well, looking back, I mean, obviously what was happening there was that the regiment was getting itself sorted out administratively. I think you were getting put into battles. The whole administrative thing, I mean, at that stage there must have been scores of territorial regiments and batteries who were in that state, and really you were waiting for somebody to come in and train you. That's just perfect.
Were you doing any training of any note?
At the beginning of the war, a lot of our time was spent digging trenches in fields. What exactly were you doing?
Round Seaburn,
yeah. You were a ready source of labour. I mean, people were digging trenches all over.
What for? I mean, were they slit trenches? Were they sort of like a First World War trench with continuous?
There were trenches as you conceived them from the First World War. You sandbagged them. And whether they were for air raids or what, I don't know. What the thinking was behind it, I really don't know.
Did you find, you'd been a clerk, did you find that tough?
No, because, as I said,
while you were doing the track, the running
track. One of the most useful things I ever did.
What else were you doing during that period?
I suppose it was fairly easy.
Did you get any gun drill? Or?
No.
So you were still pretty ignorant of gun drill from the sound of it.
That's right. We're now talking September, October. I think it's time to say that I left that regiment very quickly for a particular reason, which a lot of people don't remember. But at the beginning of the war, Parliament had passed an act saying that no person under the age of 19 was allowed to serve abroad, which I find remarkable, because now, as far as I can see, you can go abroad at any age. You'd think the position would be reversed. You'd think that people would be more and more careful. The history of that, I'm not sure, it was some woman MP who got the idea in their head that you were not mature enough. And these people were called immatures, so you were transferred. You were transferred from what was potentially a regiment that would go abroad to regiments that would not go abroad. I say potentially for good reason. So anybody under the age of 19 was transferred from the 123 to an anti-aircraft regiment in Garrow.
And what was the, do you remember its number? And
yes, it was the 87th Heavy Anti-Aircraft Regiment. And we were transferred to 278 Battery.
Still as a gunner.
So really, this is when
when did that happen? Sorry.
November 1939.
How did you feel about that?
Oh, I did. We didn't like it at all. It was,
was Spicker with you?
Yes.
How many went?
I would think there was probably about 30 or 40 of us. And, well, we all felt a bit resentful. I mean, we felt we were, as you do when you're young, you think you're going to be pushed into some backwater and you're not going to do anything, et cetera, et cetera. But as it turned out, we joined this territorial battery, which still was, it hadn't been formed very long, it was still training, but almost immediately we were given specific training and were put on to do something for the first time which was remotely connected to the war.
Now, they were based in Jarrah. Whereabouts in Jarrah?
Jarrow and Heaven, where they were based.
And were you in billets or in?
Oh yes, we were in a school council.
Now, what was this special training you were put? Well, war-related training.
We were given intensive training on the Lewis gun. The Lewis gun. Maybe I shouldn't have said any anti-aircraft. We hadn't done any. We hadn't done any heavy anti-aircraft training. And our job, and it was rather funny when you think of it, because we'd been sent to this thing because we're supposed to be too immature to be soldiers. And we were given Lewis guns, and we were given very good training. Now,
what do you remember about your training in the Lewis gun?
Well, the people who trained us, again, had been regular soldiers, but they were from a battery, a territory. But they were regular soldiers, some of them from the First World War, many of them between the war. And the chaplain trained us was a sergeant who was extremely competent on the Lewis gun. And we were young chaps, 17 or 18, 18. And in a very short space of time, we were very, very good on the Lewis gun.
Did you have to strip it?
Strip it? Oh, yes, you had to strip it and do it in a certain amount of time as well before you passed out.
What about stoppages and firing?
Stoppages and firing, yes.
What was it like to fire the Lewis gun?
I didn't find it really any different from the Bren. I suppose it was heavier, but it was certainly more clumsy to handle.
Had you used a Bren at that stage?
No.
That's with later, yeah. Did you think it was an effective weapon? Because it was just being replaced, really, wasn't it, by the Bren?
Yes. But the reason we were using the Lewis guns were not for ground, but for anti-aircraft defence. And right anti-aircraft defence, obviously we were short of all sorts of things. And our job at this time was to go to the top of Dunstan Power Station. And there was a power station still there at the time. And these things were mounted on the top.
That's on top of the big.
Not
on top of the chimneys, then.
No, on the flat roof at the top. In a sandbagged sort of enclosure. And these were to fire at low-flying aircraft if they had come at the time. Now, at that time, I don't know, the mood in the country was. I mean, you didn't really think that the Germans were going to, the war had been on for 3 or 4 months and nothing very much had happened. But I suppose looking back, it was more than possible that low flying aircraft could have come up at the time. And the funny thing was, here would have been lads being rejected as being immature, standing with these quite inadequate loose guns, I suppose, on top of buildings which would hardly have been best place to be.
Now, you've been taught about the Lewis gun, but firing the Lewis gun in the butts, I presume you'd...
We fired it on the ground.
Had you done any practice at deflection and, firing at aircraft?
Yes, roughly. You'd be given aim so much ahead.
Had you done any actual practice against drogues or anything?
No, we haven't. No. But we fired them from these tripods. I can't remember what we fired them. They're probably a fixed target. I can't remember. But that was our job, and we used to touch off at an early hour in the morning, about 5 o'clock, and we used to stay there all day and come back in the evening.
Was it not manned during the night then?
Maybe, yes.
But you were on the day shift.
Well, I think that's my memory of it, perhaps I was saying that. I can't even remember.
Well, wasn't that, was that all, what did you do all day? I mean, that's a long time to be sat on top of a power station.
Well, I mean, that's hardly like any, most of the times it spent sitting on your backside, isn't it? As I seem to remember, you had a troop, or whatever we call ourselves, part of the battery, would have, say, four, or whatever it was, guns, and you just take turns, and there was a hut or something, you used to go in there, and spoke, just like guard duty, but you were there, you were on duty.
So there's a hut up there as well?
Well, I can't remember, but some sort of a building. And there was always two men standing by.
Now, did you ever have any alarms while you were up there?
They had alarms, yes, but nothing ever happened.
How did you receive notice of an alarm? Was there a communication system built into,
presumably, there was a telephone system, but the air raid siren used to go.
So that was your main warning, as far as...
That was the main warning. I think it only happened once.
Were you nervous when it went off?
You always have this funny thing. A bit of a sort of, bit of excitement. I mean, you were pretty ignorant of what was going to happen to you.
So how long were you doing that for?
Oh, I don't know. It was obviously a task that was being given to this regiment. We did a stint of it, I suppose. I remember it was over Christmas. I was on Christmas 39. Well, I say over Christmas, it was around that period, January. Possibly, I remember doing four or five turns of it.
And a turn would be how long?
Well, as I said, we used to get up about 5 in the morning.
Oh, so that was just one shift. But would you be up there for a week doing a shift?
Oh, no. We used to come back every night back to the school, if I remember myself.
And what other activities were you doing with the 87th? I mean, were you actually learning anything about heavy anti-aircraft guns?
After that phase, probably somebody else took over, we started training... Well, there were already anti-aircraft batteries stationed around here. 3-inch anti-aircraft guns and 3.7 anti-aircraft guns. And quite simply, we went to the batteries that were in position and we'd go through there.
So you didn't have your own guns?
Not at that stage.
What was the difference, other than size, between the 3-inch and the 3.7? I mean, were they...
Well, size, the three inch was loaded by hand. You punched the thing. 3.7 was a much more sophisticated, higher muscle velocity. I don't know what it was at the time, but I'm speaking out of my time. It had a loading tray, which strangely enough, subsequently did away with. We loaded that by hand as well, and the shell was pretty heavy. Much more effective weapon. But we trained on both.
What was the base? How many men were there in a gun team?
I should know. Sergeant, two layers.
Two layers?
Two layers, yes. First of all, that's me. The sergeant, that's three. A load of four denomination men. few seconds. I think about seven. I mean, don't worry, I can't remember that day.
So the sergeant was in overall control.
Right,
and one layer laid elevation, and the other one did side to side. The loader just rammed it in, whichever way, whether it was on the tray or the other gun.
That's right. If it was on the tray, you had a toggle and it went in. But the other one,
the ammunition numbers would fetch the ammunition and hand it to the loader. Was the fuse, what was that related to?
The distance it would go before it burst. I mean, fuse 2 would be short, you know, go 2,000 feet and burst. And so on. So, because you needed three things. You needed the elevation. You were in three elements, weren't you? You needed the elevation, the lateral. And I've even forgotten what you call that now. And then, of course, the distance for it to go through.
And that was done by the fuse setting.
At that time, most of the fuse setting was still done by hand. You had a little thing like a sort of tin opener, screwed fuse to it. And then you handed it to the loader, who loaded it, and of course there was a fellow on the breech to open the breech.
Now, were there different types of shell, or were there just one common type?
There were one common, well, no, there were different types of shell. There were two basic, the ordinary AG shell, and there was a shrapnel. The shrapnel shell was supposed to be used for short range for dive bombing. It was rarely, if ever, used. But they were too.
Was it a real shrapnel shell? I mean, with little with bullets in it.
Not as people loosely talk about shrapnel these days, being bits of shell placing. It was a shrapnel.
Now, did you'd go to these two units, one with the 3-inch, one with the 3.7. Did you get the chance to actually fire them?
Not then. No. You just get training.
So practice your gun drill. And anything else you were doing during this period? This is edging into 1940 now.
Yes, the early part of 1940.
So your day would be, you'd be at Jarrow, and then you'd be sent out to a unit. Would you go back each night?
Yes, we did. And you were doing basic training as well, of course, drilling and small arms and all the rest of it. All that was going on.
Did you fit in well with the 87th? I mean, were there the same slight frictions between yourself and perhaps some of the East End lads? Or?
Oh, no. By this time, I mean, a lot of the young lads came with us. And we ourselves became a little... we all went into one troop or whatever. Called the Immatures, we call them. And of course, a very excellent troop we made because we were young and keen. But, so we had our own identity, regardless of who we were. And as I say, I still meet a very good friend of mine. That was one of the chaps I knew from there, who was pretty rough down to that time.
And what was his name?
Johnny Morris.
So by now that had gone then.
Yes.
So what happened next then?
Well, that lasted, in other words, what was happening to this anti-aircraft unit, it was doing its training as it went along. Basic training, high training on the guns. And of course, although you didn't fire the guns, the gun drill would have been pretty skillful at the gun drill. Then we moved to actual training camp. I'm not quite sure of the sequence, but I think the first one was in Scotland, an anti-aircraft firing range. Southwest tip.
Never mind. Right up in the corner then, was it?
No, down at the bottom, you know, if you go to Glasgow, the bit that...
Sorry, yes, I've got the wrong way around.
Galloway. Anyhow, as we were, and we went there, I can't remember how much, the weather was atrocious, we were under canvas, and we were gun practice serious, hard gun practice, firing at drones.
How accurate were you in those early days?
Well, Well, we certainly improved a great deal. And of course, the aircraft pulling these goats weren't particularly fast. And the aircraft gunnery or incoming, I suppose that matters. It all depends what you mean by accurate. We had freedom dimensions to deal with. You get the thing on the tower, so you were right that way and that way. You still had to get it the first one, I think. Quite good. I seem to remember somebody saying that the regiment had passed out with a fairly high standard. So we did work hard.
Did you have your own guns by then?
No, they were the guns belonging to the training.
So when would that be roughly you were at the training camp, or is it? And what next then?
Right, I'm trying to remember because when we finished there, we were then considered to be fit for defence service, and we moved into the Middlesbrough area, 3.7 and some of us on 4.5.
And how many guns would the battery control, you were 278 battery and the immature troop, still as the immature troop. So how many guns would there be in the 278 battery?
278 battery, that would be 8 guns and 2 troops. I hope I'm getting this right. But each site consisted of 4 guns.
And that would be a troop site, would it?
Yes.
And do you remember the number or letter of your troop?
You know, they used to call it right half and left half.
And which were you? That's fine. You can't remember. So where was your troop based, or where your?
We were sometime at Grangetown in Middlesbrough, and also in Norton.
And how was an anti-aircraft site organised then? I mean,
The captain, usually a captain or a director. Well, there was the battery headquarters, which were away from the sites. 2 sites, I think, under the battery commander, 4 guns each. The battery commander with battery headquarters, that was usually a billeting in town somewhere. The troop, the site, the typical site, it had huts on it. The guns were in pits.
What were the pit? Each gun in a separate pit. And how? What dimensions for the pit? How much dug in?
Well, some of them were man-made concrete pits. There were plenty of room to work around because you had all your shells around, because when you did start firing, you fired a lot of shells. A roomy gun pit. Some of them, the 4.5s, were always mounted on concrete and then built in. They had a big, rather like a naval gun. They had their own shield on them. The 4.5 is the biggest anti aircraft.
With 3.7, would you dig in yourself then?
No, well, I can't remember whether we did or we didn't. I think in some cases the sites were prepared. It was probably more efficient.
How far between guns, roughly?
I've got a concept of it, but to try and put it in. The site was fairly big,
So well separated.
Yeah.
And just one, how did the 4.5 then, was a much bigger gun than the 3? Were there any other differences? I mean, did you need more men on the loading?
I think so, yes. I can't remember, but I suspect so, It's a much heavier shell. I can't remember the ratio, but much heavier.
So you were settled in at Grangetown and then at Norton. Are they separated in your mind or just?
It's all fairly blurred because shortly after we settled in, and I can't remember if it was Norton or, well, certainly it was Grangetown. Grangetown was on a slag heap. When I say slag, I mean the stuff that's left over after you make steel. So that was dug in by mechanical means. You couldn't, the whole site was just lumps of rock. And of course, by the time we got settled in and practiced, well, then the air raid started. And on both sides now, you get a bit mixed up between the two.
let's sort of leave them sort of slightly. So what was your daily routine on a site then, and then perhaps incorporate the routine when an air raid happened?
Well, your daily routine is like cleaning the guns up in the morning, not the morning, usual morning parade, clean the guns, have them ready, all the usual things that had to be done on a site. I mean, by the time the gun crews had cleaned the guns, and you predict the crews and looked at that, and then there was the...
You what, crews? What was that?
That was the mechanical, electronic advisor, predictor. You put that on the aircraft, and it automatically worked out the range, the elevation, and the fuse, right? Which was conveyed by cable to the gun, which is screwed in your hand. And that worked the dials on the 200 aircraft.
So it's automatic?
But you still have to pedal it. But the information was fed to the guns that way. Oh, yeah.
So the predictor.